argument this morning, Coddington v. Carpenter, case number 166295. Counsel, we are ready to proceed. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court, Judge Lucero, counsel, Mr. Walpert, I'm John Carlson. I don't think it's a surprise based on the 28J traffic that's saturated your inbox. I want to talk about the right to present a defense claim this morning, which means I want to talk about the exclusion of Dr. Smith's expert psychiatric opinion that James Coddington, because of acute cocaine intoxication, could not form the specific intent to kill, the mens rea required to sustain malice murder. Now, I think it's helpful to orient ourselves about what the state appellate court said and did.
You're not arguing that that bears on the Miranda issue, but only independently goes to mens rea.
Correct. What I hope to talk about for the next 28 minutes has little or nothing to do with the Miranda issue. All right. If you feel differently, I'll change my mind. Okay. This is an independent error having no roots in the Miranda claim. So let's remember what the OCCA, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, said and did with the right to present a defense claim. First, it said Dr. Smith's opinion was wrongly excluded under Oklahoma law. Two, it recognized that exclusion violated Mr. Coddington's constitutional rights. But third, the error applying Chapman versus California was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, my first and primary task is to persuade you that the OCCA's harmlessness determination was an objectively unreasonable application of Chapman. And to do that, I'm going to lash myself, Odysseus-like, to the semantic mast of the OCCA's decision, that is, its words. I mean, I don't think there's going to be any surprise about the words that we're going to talk about.
With no sirens chasing you around.
Well, there is a siren chasing me, or I'm trying to avoid, and it's what I admit is the difficult 2254D standard I must surmount before we talk about anything else.
Or I should have said no sirens luring you away. more aptly put.
The first phrase I'm going to remind you of is the OCCA's declaration that the excluded evidence was not just material, it was certainly material. And given that, I can distill my right to present a defense claim as an unreasonable application of Chapman in one sentence. The exclusion of material evidence can never be harmless error by definition. Did you have a question?
Well, I think, are you going to the argument you made in your 28J letter you filed this week on the Brady, that it, I'm trying to think of the case name. I've got it in my notes here. It seemed to be you were making this argument for the first time in your 28J letter.
I filed two such.
Basically, this is akin to Brady evidence and that it's automatic.
The brief definitely. Recite Valenzuela Bernal, which imported the materiality standard from the Brady line of cases into the right to present a defense case. I cited that case.
And that's the first time you'd cited that and made that argument.
No.
Wasn't it in your 28J letter?
Quite incorrect,
okay.
Your Honor. My reply brief cites and quotes from and relies on Valenzuela Bernal repeatedly, page 12 to 14,
in terms of talking about the comparing it, the exclusion of evidence that we had here to the exclusion of opinion testimony that we had in this case. In that case, it was exclusion. I mean, the government basically deported witnesses.
Deported a witness. You're right.
So it's the total exclusion of evidence. It's unavailable. Where here, this expert testified, his opinion was excluded. And I didn't see any case law that would compare, you know, the two, I guess is what I'm saying.
I don't recall
that you did that in your reply brief.
No, and in my 28J letter, I'm not suggesting that there was the total exclusion of Dr. Smith's testimony. There wasn't. He testified a lot, and I never have denied that. He gave the jury a lot of information about cocaine addiction. What he was prevented from saying was the critical and reliable opinion that negated by itself an element of malice murder. The problem with his testimony, Judge Lord, is the jury could perfectly well accept every fact he was allowed to say. Mm-hmm. Mr. Coddington wasn't thinking rationally. He was impaired. He was paranoid. And still, the jury could convict him based on its finding that he intended to kill. None of those facts were inconsistent, in other words, with a conviction. The jury could not, however, in contrast, accept his excluded opinion and convict.
The jury was instructed with the voluntary intoxication instruction. They understood that they had to decide whether he had the requisite intent. They were given all kinds of evidence about his voluntary intoxication and how that would impair his ability to form the intent. Not the specific testimony that you are speaking of, but and then he himself testified, I believe, that he couldn't have formed the intent. And I think defense counsel pretty strongly made that argument in closing argument. The jury certainly seemed to have understood what they were supposed to do with this evidence about his level of voluntary intoxication.
I'm going to quibble with you on that, okay. Judge Moritz. I think it's at least, you ought to have at least grave doubt as to whether the jury took precisely the opposite inference from his testimony. For as the OCCA noted, what was conspicuously absent, notable was the OCCA's term, from his testimony was the one thing that would have forced an acquittal. So I think it's at least possible. Well, I'm more than that. I have to show you more than that. I think it's an equipoise whether the jury assumed that Dr. Smith in fact believed he had the intent. He, Mr. Coddington, had the intent to kill. Otherwise, he would have said so for precisely the reason Judge Moritz, you cite. He said a lot of other things. As the OCCA said, he was allowed to testify, it seemed, to everything save what really mattered.
But there was I think that the question about whether the jury believed is, I think, interesting because that's something that in finding the evidence material, I think the jury said, or the jury, the OCC said, if the jury believed this, it certainly could have factored it in terms of the degree of the homicide. But then it seemed to me that what the OCCA was saying was, we don't think the jury did believe it, would have believed it, because of all this other evidence, and some of it was his own actions, very specific actions in surrounding the crime that would indicate he knew exactly what he was doing.
Two things. First,
the OCC didn't detail that evidence, but it's part of the record.
Yes, and I don't deny that evidence. Two things in response. First, I'm not questioning whether the evidence was sufficient against Mr. Coddington. Even on this element, it was. That's not the issue. The question is what was excluded from the jury's deliberations. Two, the OCCA advanced my argument perhaps more than I have by calling it material. Then, perhaps sensing the incoherence of calling material evidence harmless, the OCCA made a bad problem worse. Recall what the OCCA said immediately after
calling the evidence harmless. The reason it was harmless is Dr. Smith's testimony would not have completely exonerated Mr. Coddington. But, quoting the OCCA, if believed by the jury, and by the way, that's no different than any right to present a defense case. The witness in Valenzuela, who was exported, his testimony would have had to be believed to be viable. So the mere fact that the finding had to be believed is not, I think, a crippling fact. But let me return to what the OCCA said. Dr. Smith's testimony, if believed, might certainly have reduced the degree of homicide for which Mr. Coddington was convicted. That was the whole point of calling Dr. Smith, was to reduce the degree of homicide.
Could you address the state's argument that they seem to focus on in their response brief, that you don't have, your habeas petition here is not based on clearly established federal law. And we've said, fairly recently in the House case, interpreting U.S. Supreme Court, fairly recent case law, that that's a threshold requirement. We can't get any further. We can't talk about D1 or D2 without that threshold clearly established federal law. And as you know, federal law doesn't even permit the federal rules of evidence in particular, and I'm not talking yet about the Supreme Court, but it doesn't even permit this opinion testimony. It prohibits it under the federal rules. And the Supreme Court, in the closest case I could find that was cited in a 28J letter, the Clark case, would seem to say, yeah, this doesn't implicate his constitutional right to present a defense, this opinion testimony. And that clearly established federal law has to be based on a case with the most specific or facts the most akin, and it seems to me that Clark case is. Sorry about the long question.
No,
I'd like you to address that because I think it's a very important argument, if that is the threshold question.
I agree. It is important. It's the heart of this case. And I sense two issues in your question, which isn't long. It's fair and to the point. Let me pull them apart.
I'm not sure I agree, but yeah.
Pull them apart. First, just to be clear, my argument is not and never has been the exclusion of Dr. Smith's evidence by itself. Just free-floating exclusion violates the Constitution. It most certainly does not. Rule 704B forecloses that argument. My argument is that the priors make the exclusion of Dr. Smith's evidence. The priors I'm referring to is a state-created right to defend yourself from malice murder on the basis of voluntary intoxication, bolstered by a state-created right to present expert testimony in advance of that defense. So my argument, to be very clear, is once the state has created these rights, unlike Arizona, which denied Clark the diminished capacity defense, unlike, say, the state of Montana, which denied Engelhoff the same right, Oklahoma took a different path. It granted defendants this right to present an intoxication defense, and it allowed such defendants to present expert testimony. And then, without justification, that's what it means to be erroneously denied, the state stripped Coddington of that right. Bingo, that's the violation of the Constitution. Now let me address the clearly established, unless there's a question about...
Let's get to the expert then, because staying on point. What was the expert at expert in, and what would his testimony have been that goes to the issue of the violation of the right to introduce evidence of intoxication as a defense?
Volume 5, page 81 of the trial record, you will find the proffer. It from Dr. Smith, an expert in psychiatry, who would have testified that because of Mr. Coddington's longtime addiction to cocaine, amplified by the three-day binge on crack cocaine, he could not possibly have formed the specific intent to kill.
That was what the jury was denied. It could not consider that opinion as it weighed the evidence.
So are the rulings on intoxication broad enough to include drug impairment?
Yes. The jury was specifically instructed that drugs are among the intoxicating toxins that could impair Mr. Coddington's intent if the jury accepted that.
Was any other evidence introduced on that point?
No. That's very important. The excluded evidence was not presented in any other form. Neither a witness nor any document supplied what Dr. Smith could have said, which isn't to say, to repeat, that the jury was ignorant about the effects of cocaine on Mr. Coddington. It got quite an education, but it didn't get the critical element negating evidence. And I'm itching to get back to House, unless there's a question. I haven't forgotten that, because I do view that as a problem.
Well, in House, we pointed out what the court already said, and the Supreme Court said in Carey, which is the Supreme Court holdings are the exclusive touchstone for clearly established federal law, and they must be construed narrowly and consist only of something akin to on-point holdings. Why doesn't Clark, the Supreme Court's holding in Clark, control this case and say that there is no clearly established federal law, so we don't make it past that threshold determination in this circumstance?
Well, because, as I said, Arizona denied the
I understand that,
defense.
But we're still talking about clearly established federal law that must be based on Supreme Court holdings.
But what's important in both Clark and, I think, House is there was no finding of constitutional error in the state court. That is in sharp contrast to
There's still
question.
A threshold question.
But I'm
and that was the case in House. Wasn't House the case where there was the threshold determination by the state court that Batson applied?
No.
Am I getting that
You're
mixed
getting,
up?
The state court
Which case
ruled,
is that?
What happened is,
Not House. That Batson applied. When they applied Batson, they decided it didn't apply. But this court said Batson didn't apply in the first instance. There was no clearly established federal law saying that Batson applied in the first instance. So
Correct.
The state court got that wrong. And the defendant certainly wasn't making that argument.
Judge Moore, with due respect, I think you're wrong.
Okay.
When you read House, I hope
I did read that, House.
You will see that the state court of New Mexico refused the equal protection challenge to the change of venue that was at issue. So there was no constitutional.
They attempted to. They discussed Batson and decided that Batson didn't apply.
Didn't extend to
but
venue.
But this court said you shouldn't even have got to Batson because Batson hadn't been extended to these venue changes,
right.
And so it backed it up a notch, which is what we're doing here. We're backing it up a notch and said, Oklahoma Supreme Court, you should not have even talked about this being a constitutional, essentially a denial of a constitutional right without there being some clearly established federal law. Well, I say that. The Oklahoma Court of Appeals wasn't even discussing clearly established federal law. This was a direct appeal. They were interpreting the law as they saw it. But we have the obligation to decide as a threshold matter whether this is based on clearly established federal law.
Yeah, well, let me, on that
Sorry.
Point.
Okay,
no, I'm not interrupting. I just want to pursue Judge Lawrence's point. On the issue of whether the violation of a state-granted right, isn't there Supreme Court law that says that the U.S. Constitution Due Process Clause does grant relief on that point?
Yes, if the right is substantial.
That's what I thought. What are those cases?
It's Hicks versus Oklahoma. But why don't I just say it, because this is what I've been itching to.
Yeah.
Well, don't just stop itching and just say it.
I want to replace the analog in your mind from Clark House to Ayala. The distinction here is that in Ayala, we have the analogous situation. We have a finding of constitutional error, but harmless. And Ayala's
lights the pathway. The first pass is to show the 2254D violation that was found in the state court, though ruled harmless. Ayala says the first thing you do is to ask whether that was a clearly, an objectively unreasonable application of Chapman. And so Ayala is the more appropriate analog because there the case arrived in the federal courts with the error that I have presented you. Unlike House, unlike Clark, they could not get through the constitutional portal. So when they arrived in the federal courts, they did not have what I have, which is a judgment from the state court, a final judgment, declaring the error constitutionally harmless. You draw then from the Ayala, Frye versus Plyler line of cases, which isn't to say I can walk out of this courtroom writ in hand without persuading you that Mr. Coddington's rights were violated, constitutional rights were violated. The question is, under what standard, and then when do I do it? My position is, the first question is, did the state court get Chapman right? If it did, game over, I lose. If I'm correct, if you're persuaded that the exclusion of material evidence can never be harmless, then you put to me the question, under de novo review, having surmounted 2254D's precondition to relief, do I have a constitutional violation? And if so, did I suffer actual prejudice? Now I'm ready to fight with you about whether I have a constitutional violation, but I'm free of the limited source of law that I can draw on because I have penetrated through, I have surmounted 2254D's precondition of relief. Unless there are other questions, I think I want to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
May it please the court, I'm Caroline Hunt from the Oklahoma Attorney General's Office on behalf of respondent. This court should hold that the Court of Criminal Appeals Chapman harmlessness determination.
I think that you should not be like Dionysius, walking around with a lantern in the light of day, to try to outdo Mr. Carlson on his Greek rhetoric. But I'd like to ask you a point that he did make that I think is a bit troubling. Does Oklahoma, in fact, extend an intoxication defense to a mens rea, on mens rea?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the defendant then seek to introduce expert testimony of his impairment by calling an expert witness on point?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
And was that testimony excluded?
There was a single line of testimony excluded. And here's what happened. Okay. At the time this case went to trial, everyone believed, including defense counsel, that this expert capacity opinion, Dr. Smith's opinion on whether petitioner was so intoxicated that he couldn't form the intent to kill, was actually precluded under Oklahoma law. And I'll read to you from
Just a second.
Yeah, sure.
Don't go too fast because...
Sorry, Your Honor.
Yesterday we had a lawyer arguing so fast that I finally had to say, look, if we can't understand you, we can't help you, so slow it down.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think Judge Hartz had to step in, and we finally gave the young lady advice at the end of the argument that she enroll in an undergraduate course in rhetoric, because she asked anything that we could do to help, we would, and so I thought that was the best she could do. I'm not going to advise you to go to a course in rhetoric. Which
Thank
is
you, Your Honor.
Down. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to follow you and
sure.
the logical premises here and slow it down. Okay,
yes.
So start again.
So when it came time to discuss Dr. Smith's upcoming testimony,
right,
the trial court asked defense counsel, do you intend to ask Dr. Smith whether your client was capable of forming the specific intent of committing the crime? And defense counsel responded, Your Honor, we would make that question in his answer as an
officer. Just a second. He responded what?
We would make that question and his answer as an offer of proof for the court because we know that White versus State states that an expert cannot testify as to that particular aspect. So that's one clarifying point I would like to make, is that everyone at the time, including defense counsel, believed that the capacity opinion was excludable, that was prohibited
under Oklahoma law. Under Oklahoma state law.
Yes. But then what happened, we had the trial in 2003, and then in 2004, while petitioner's direct appeal was pending, the Court of Criminal Appeals decided a case called Johnson, in which they seemed to expand that area of the law and said you could introduce this kind of testimony. And then when they decided petitioner's case, they did say very clearly once and for all that this kind of capacity opinion is admissible under Oklahoma law. But it is not the case that this was some type of arbitrary or disparate application of the rule. The trial court and the parties simply misunderstood the law and believed that this was not admissible under Oklahoma law.
But in fact, the correct ruling anticipating that second case would have been that the testimony should have been allowed.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Yes.
So why isn't that a violation of the state-granted right to introduce evidence of intoxication impairment?
The only case that petitioner has cited for that theory is Hicks, and I'll answer your question, but first I'll just reiterate
I appreciate the level of your candor.
Yes, that it is a brand new, unexhausted, forfeited, and waived claim. However, even if we look to the merits of that, what happened in Hicks is a defendant was deprived of a state-created right to jury sentencing. And courts have interpreted Hicks basically to say that it stands for the narrow proposition that some state-created rights are so fundamental that it basically creates a liberty interest in that right, and you can't be arbitrarily deprived of it. And petitioner has cited no case suggesting that the state law right to introduce a capacity opinion is on that level, that it's so fundamental, it's like what happened in Hicks, and that it would be an arbitrary deprivation. And as far as the right to present a defense line of cases, petitioner continually attempts to distinguish his cases based on the state law right, but that shows only an error of state law. To follow his logic.
But under error, error of state law can result in a Hicks violation, can it not?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in limited circumstances, like what happened in Hicks, if it is such a fundamental right, and I don't think
what
there's...
What right can be more fundamental than the right to introduce evidence that your intoxication prevented you from forming the specific intent necessary to commit the crime, to be convicted of the crime?
I think if it were a case where it was excluded on whole, if it was an exclusion much greater than what we have here.
I asked Mr. Carlson if there was other evidence that was introduced that we could look at that could have been substituted for that evidence, and I think his answer was no.
And I disagree with that, Your Honor. This claim comes down to one line, six words. What Dr. Smith was not allowed to say was at the time of the murder, petitioner was not able to form the intent of malice aforethought. He was able to say, in his opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, petitioner was not able to think reasonably and rationally on the day of the murder. So six words, form the intent of malice aforethought. That's all that was excluded here. There was no, and also, as Judge Moritz pointed out, the petitioner.
Six words.
Yes, to form the intent of malice aforethought. That was the only thing that Dr. Smith was not permitted to say.
Well, bloody well, that seemed to me the most critical point, right?
And
I think Mr. Carlson made that argument, that he was allowed to testify on everything, but the point that was really the money shot.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll explain now why that was not outcome determinative and not critical. Even had Dr. Smith said these words, which I call his capacity opinion as shorthand, the jury was not required to accept that opinion. The jury was instructed in instruction number 20. You may consider the testimony, I'm sorry, and this is as to expert witnesses. You may consider the testimony of these witnesses and give it such weight and value as you think it should have, but the weight and value to be given their testimony is for you to determine. You are not required to surrender your own judgment to that of any person testifying.
How is this relevant? I mean, if you tell the jury you can consider all the evidence this expert gave, but you don't have to set aside your own thinking processes and the process of listening to it, or your own judgment, but they didn't hear the evidence in the first place, I don't see how that helps the state in any way. I mean,
yes, sir.
I just, or helps the defendant either. I just think it's irrelevant.
Because what my point is that the jury was not bound to accept that capacity opinion, even
that's
if it had been rendered.
That's what I'm saying. There was no capacity opinion.
Right. And that's what I'm about to explain.
As I said to Mr. Carlson, please don't itch. Just tell us. I'd say the same thing to you. Please don't. About to explain. Just explain.
Sure. So here are all the reasons that the jury would never have accepted the capacity opinion, even had it been given. And so the first thing I want to talk about is the timeline as far as the degree to which petitioner would.
So this is kind of a harmless.
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly. This goes back to my opening point, and I didn't make that clear. But the points I wanted to get across to this court had to do with why this court should find the Court of Criminal Appeals harmlessness determination reasonable, and why this court should have no grave doubt under Brecht. So as to the timeline, petitioner bludgeoned 73-year-old Al Hale four times in the head around 6:30 p.m. on March 5th, 1997.
Okay, so spotting you that, you would agree that that's not rational. Killing somebody over the head with a claw hammer is not a rational act.
I think it was completely rational under these circumstances because petitioner didn't want to go back to prison.
What am I missing here? I mean, what's rational about that?
Petitioner went there with the express purpose to obtain more money for more cocaine. And when Mr. Hale refused to give it to him, he bludgeoned him repeatedly so then he could take the money and leave. And so I think it was rational in that sense.
The rational act is the killing to get the money.
Yes, exactly. Like, it had a purpose. It's rational in that sense. That was his purpose.
So are you saying it's the nature of the bludgeoning, the four times with the hammer, that somehow established his intent to kill him rather than simply maim him or incapacitate him somehow? Because I'm struggling with that here.
Yes, I think those are some of the things that factor in. What I'm trying to get here is the totality of the circumstances. And yes, I think it's relevant that he continued to hit him after the first time. But my point was actually, I was trying to establish the timeline as to his level of intoxication, that the killing happened around 6:30 p.m. that day, and the last robbery that had occurred before that was around 2:30 a.m., so around 16 hours before the murder. And petitioner, as I just said, admitted he went to Mr. Hale's house because he needed more money for cocaine. He admitted on the stand that every time he committed a robbery and got money, he would immediately buy cocaine would immediately spoke it up and would save it for later.
He didn't also testify that he went into the bathroom and used cocaine while he was there at the home?
That's correct, Your Honor, but that was when he said that on the stand, it was the first time he'd ever said that in 5 years.
He testified to it.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, but as far as weighing how the jury would have evaluated this this capacity opinion had it been given, it's relevant that he did not say that during his police interview. He did not say that during his meeting with Dr. Smith, and in fact, Dr. Smith said on the stand that it was his understanding that it was sometime in the hours before petitioner went over to Mr. Hale's house that he had last used cocaine. And then Dr. Smith said that generally without using additional cocaine, the actual high is over in about 20 to 30 minutes. And that's on page 24 of the volume 6 of the trial transcripts. And it's only after hearing Dr. Smith's testimony that petitioner gets on the stand and for the first time ever in 5 years says, I used cocaine in Mr. Hale's bathroom. And so I think that all of those, the fact that it had never been said before and the question of why he would save cocaine all day, having before said, I smoked it up immediately, and also it undermines Dr. Smith in that he never says how he could be so intoxicated that he lacked self-awareness, which was something he was absolutely allowed to testify about. Despite the fact that the high is over in 20 to 30 minutes. And by his own evaluation of petitioner, he had believed had been hours since petitioner had used cocaine. The other point I want to make as to harmlessness is the test for intoxication is petitioner has to show that at the time of the crime, his mental powers were so overcome through intoxication that it was impossible for him to form malice aforethought. And the two manifestations that Dr. Smith discussed at length were, one, that petitioner would lack self-awareness, and two, that petitioner would have memory deficits. Memory deficits.
All right.
And the evidence did not show these things. And before I discuss the evidence, I want to take a moment to discuss specifically Dr. Smith's testimony as to memory deficits. Petitioner makes the claim in his reply brief that his memory of the crime is not inconsistent with intoxication. However, Dr. Smith said in his report that petitioner had a spotty memory of the crime. And while Dr. Smith also says that cocaine intoxication wouldn't interfere pervasively with memory and that there wouldn't be a complete blocking of memory of what one has done, that suggests that you would have some memory deficits. It wouldn't be pervasive. And the problem for petitioner is he has a total lack of memory deficits. As I describe in my brief, there are numerous details he remembers. And I would also direct this court to pages 12 to 24.
So your argument is he wasn't, as a matter of fact, intoxicated or influenced.
Yes, I think either he was not intoxicated. I mean, I think the testimony from Dr. Smith is that cocaine could, even if your high was over, your judgment could be affected.
Just a second. Let me make sure I follow the rational thought here. The testimony would have been that in the opinion of the doctor, the defendant was influenced by intoxication under Oklahoma law.
Yes.
And you're arguing that that he was not intoxicated because why?
Well, that first, the timeline. It makes no sense that he saved this cocaine all day.
The height of the intoxication would have been 30 minutes after consumption or
right.
after use or whatever you do with it. But that doesn't mean you're not under the influence. It just means that the peak was at a certain point, right?
And I totally agree, Your Honor. And Dr. Smith made that point. In fact, he showed brain scans to the jury that said even 10 days out, 90 days out, your judgment, your frontal lobe is still affected. So, yes, I agree that the cocaine would still have some effect on him. But the question is, and what he had to show is, did it render him so intoxicated that he was unable to form the specific intent to kill? And two manifestations of Dr. Smith's reasoning that he was so affected by the cocaine was that he would have that he had a spotty memory and a lack of self-awareness. And so my point is, when you look at all of the evidence, it absolutely does not show either a spotty memory or a lack of self-awareness. But yes, I agree with Your Honor that it would still have some effect on him.
I'm not arguing his case. I mean, that's not my role. And I'm not saying he was or wasn't. I'm just trying to understand your argument.
Yes.
I think your argument is that this is harmless because he wasn't intoxicated. But now you're saying that he would have been influenced, that it could have been. I don't know.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm just having trouble following the argument.
Sure. So one of the things Dr. Smith said is that the degree to which the cocaine affects you is related to the time when it happened. In other words, as time goes on, you're less under the effect.
Right.
And so my point is just, I think it can be either thing. Whether he did smoke cocaine in the bathroom, and was intoxicated at the time, he still...
Is that what you do with cocaine, smoke it?
It's one of the ways you can consume it, and it's how petitioner said he used it. And that apparently produces the fastest high.
Okay.
Whether he used cocaine in the bathroom and was high at the time, he still was not to the point of not being able to form intent, because the measure of that is the self-awareness and memory deficits. So I think that even if he was high, we still don't have those markers. And then my alternative point is that there was also a lot of evidence to suggest he was not high at that time and it had been hours since he used cocaine. And based on Dr. Smith's testimony that the effects lessen over time, that again undermines that capacity opinion and shows why no jury would have accepted it, even had it been rendered.
Could you address his argument about what's the proper pathway for us to take in light of your argument about the lack of clearly established law, federal law, with respect to the actual denial of the opinion evidence, capacity evidence? He suggests that he points to Ayala and suggests that because we are, the challenge here is to the harmless error, that, and we do have clearly established federal law as to the harmless error standard, and there's a question about what that is here, but why isn't that our pathway instead of the way that you, I think you approached it in your brief, which is to first discuss the clearly established, the existence of clearly established laws to the right to present the testimony itself?
Is
he correct about that? Do we approach it first from the harmless error and then go to, if we get past that?
No, Your Honor, and first, as you discussed with Petitioner's Counsel, we have House v. Hatch that describes it as a threshold showing. And I agree, it's not perfectly on point. I can't point to a case that is perfectly on point with this issue. As far as his point about Ayala, honestly, I have not read it recently enough to remember the constitutional
claim.
Why
isn't the threshold issue here? Do we have clearly established federal law as to the harmless error standard? Yes, we do. That's his argument.
Yes, that's true. But as far as the clearly established law requirement, besides the characterization as a threshold requirement, it is somewhat a policy argument that it seems strange to punish a state court where it interpreted the Constitution more favorably than clearly established Supreme Court law requires with more review, whereas another state court finds no constitutional error and we have no clearly established Supreme Court law to then say, you know, review would be cut off at that point because of the lack of clearly established law. And so basically I'm making it is a policy argument combined with House v. Hatch's language that this is a threshold determination. And as far as Ayala, I don't recall the constitutional error at issue there, but I don't know if there was an argument made that we had to make a threshold showing that it was actually constitutional error under clearly established
law. But in House, the state Supreme Court, New Mexico court, I believe, hadn't found, as we have here, a constitutional error.
You're right, Your Honor.
So that's a big distinction as far mm-hmm. as where we look at that threshold issue, I guess.
Yes, and I agree that that is a distinction, and I don't have a case perfectly okay. on point. And when I wrote my brief, I had to make a decision about how to set it out, and I kind of finally separated those, you know, the question of whether there's a federal constitutional error and then whether there's clearly established constitutional error, because I think the former is probably more clear. I mean, it's definitely a fundamental tenet of habeas that you have to have federal constitutional error. See, for example, Estelle v. McGuire. And I admit it's less clear as to the clearly established law requirement. But that is my position there. And the other thing I would add...
What's your best case for there not being any federal constitutional error?
I think probably a combination of Sheffer and Clark.
You cited those in your
yes.
in your 28J brief.
Right. And so what happened is when I briefed it, I tried to make that point that federal courts have drawn a distinction between capacity opinions and the other types of evidence you can present in support of this kind of claim and have said it does not violate your right to present a defense. And I think that is only reinforced by Clark and Sheffer, that these types of capacity opinions, it does not infringe upon a weighty interest of the accused. And back to the point that petitioner has to show.
Of course, neither of those cases involved a state where we have state common law here that mm-hmm. actually establishes the right to present this opinion testimony.
Yes, and that's where I think 2 points. First, like I said, I think that sounds more like his Hicks claim, which is totally forfeited and waived, and also not fundamental like Hicks. And the second thing is, as far as the right to present a defense case, the only difference I see that makes from these other right to present a defense cases is he's shown a state law error. It doesn't then follow automatically that he's shown a federal constitutional violation. Otherwise, I think that would make a nullity of the rule in Estelle that there has to be more than just a violation of state law. And so he has to go on then and still meet the same test. In other words, whether it's an allegedly unconstitutional evidentiary rule or an allegedly unconstitutional trial court ruling, like he's claiming here, he still has to show that a weighty interest was infringed.
If that were the test, was a weighty interest infringed, I just have a hard time from where I sit saying that the deprivation of the right or the deprivation of an offer to introduce evidence of impairment at the time of the commission of the crime, which is authorized under and which is permitted under Oklahoma state law, is not a weighty interest. I mean, if that's the test, holy cats, that seems to me not a very hard question to answer. The more difficult question for me to answer is the line that you were following is to say, well, even though that right may have been impaired, this was harmless because, and it's when I get to the QED of your because mm-hmm. that I pause because I think you're telling me that the reason it's harmless is because you feel that the jury would have found him not to be impaired because of his ability to recollect events, mm-hmm. which is a marker, and one other...
His self-awareness, Your Honor.
His self-awareness, which is a marker.
Yes. Your Honor, can I go back to your first point?
Right, yes, and I'd like to perhaps Mr. Carlson will address those two
okay.
points in his argument.
Okay,
yes.
So the first thing, I want to be clear. Back to the 6 lines of testimony that was excluded.
Yes.
There was not any factual or observational testimony excluded. No evidence about cocaine intoxication was excluded. Dr. Smith was able to give his expert opinions about petitioner's cocaine dependency and the effect it had on petitioner's brain. It truly comes down to these six words. There was a wealth of evidence through petitioner's ex-fiance, Michelle Martin, through petitioner himself, through Dr. Smith and his review of records, his review of summaries basically from petitioner's family about his history of cocaine use. Dr. Smith testified to why petitioner was more vulnerable to cocaine intoxication, that he had a history of head injuries and an early exposure to alcohol. All of that came in. This claim really comes down to these six words with this capacity opinion. Right. And so that is my point, that there was not a weighty interest infringed. And the Supreme Court has drawn a distinction between the kind of factual observational evidence and all of the kind of evidence he did get to put in versus the expert capacity opinion. And then to your second point, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct that why this capacity opinion would not have been accepted comes down in particular to the lack of memory deficits, the lack of self-awareness. And I want to talk more about the self-awareness. Petitioner says that after he bludgeoned Mr. Hale, he looked down and realized what he'd done. And no reasonable juror would ever have accepted that his mental powers were so overcome that he couldn't intend to kill, but that immediately thereafter, he realized what he'd done and thought to take money from Mr. Hale's pocket. And another evidence of self-awareness is petitioner says he started to take Mr. Hale's rings off, but couldn't do it, again demonstrating that his mental powers were sufficiently intact for him to feel guilty, and that also contradicts Mr. Smith's opinion that he was allowed to give that severe cocaine intoxication affects one's ethics. And so that is a moment where petitioner showed both ethics and self-awareness. Petitioner testified that he left Mr. Hale's house without contacting the police because he didn't want to get caught. He washed his hands in the kitchen sink and wrapped the murder weapon, the hammer, in a newspaper. He was able to drive himself away, make the 20-minute drive to Oklahoma City to buy more cocaine. Afterward, he disposed of the murder weapon and washed his clothes. He returned later to try to take some of Mr. Hale's possessions to pawn them, but then he saw police lights, again showing his awareness, and turned around and left, again showing his awareness that he'd done wrong and his desire not to get caught up, to get caught. And to sum up, for the three reasons
sum up, because I want to ask you a question, if I may, please. We're going to go off the clock here. Not off the clock, but extend the clock.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Because we'll have to treat Mr. Carlson with the same equivalence. The question I have is this.
Mm-hmm.
Just to summarize your argument,
mm-hmm.
Under Oklahoma law, he had the right to introduce evidence of impairment. The judge did not allow the ultimate opinion on that point because of his understanding of Oklahoma law, which he interpreted to mean that he was not allowed to introduce that evidence.
Yes.
And subsequent to that, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that the evidence is admissible, which means that it should have been admitted.
Yes.
And what is the consequence of that from your perspective? Does that mean that we have to presume the judge's ruling was wrong, given the reflection of the later reflection of the Oklahoma courts?
Yes, as a matter of state law, yes. Because the Court of Criminal Appeals, it was interpreting both its recent case, Johnson, but also its prior cases.
Okay.
And so I think the Court of Criminal Appeals has the final say on that. And even though everyone at the time was interpreting it differently, said, yes, under Oklahoma law, this should have been admitted. So I think it's a matter of state law.
And I'm not, believe me, I'm not at the gotcha game. But are you basically then conceding that under Oklahoma law, properly applied, that ruling was erroneous and that we must resort to a harmless error, to the same harmless error review that the Oklahoma courts applied and that the district court applied?
Only in part, Your Honor. I concede that it was an error under state law, but I still think this court has to make a preliminary determination of whether it was federal constitutional error, which would then allow this court to apply harmless error review what the Court of Criminals did under Chapman.
But we've gone through that.
But only if we get past harmless error first.
I'm sorry,
But only if we get past harmless error first.
No.
At least according to Mr. Carlson.
I don't agree with that position.
Okay.
I think there is
some importance in the way we, the pathway here.
Right. I think that it is a threshold determination. And even setting aside, I think, the more unsettled question of whether the clearly established law requirement applies at that time, I do think this court would need to first find, before you get to harmless error analysis, whether it's federal constitutional error. I mean, I think in a simpler case where we just had, what's clearly simply state law error, it would be unavoidable. Like, that can't open the door to harmless error review in federal court. And I contend this case should be in the same boat, that there has to be that preliminary determination that this is federal constitutional error before this court proceeds to harmless error review.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll extend 3 minutes to Mr. Carlson's time. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Ask this court to affirm the denial of habeas relief.
Yes, we really do have a disagreement about the order here. I think the order that I set out is consistent with Williams and Eddie versus Corderman, the harmless error cases, Plyler, Ayala. The threshold requirement is to attack the state court judgment that's adverse to me, and that's the harmlessness determination. I make it through that. I still have to show a constitutional error under Bernal, but de novo.
Well, you don't have to do anything. It's defendant ultimately you're advocating on his behalf, and it's, I think, more helpful to analyze the law purely without getting all this involvement of what you have to do and don't have to do. Would you please answer Judge Moritz's question? And that is the order and your point of disagreement as to the order of presentation of the harmlessness. If you understand my question.
I guess I don't.
We pursued this case to the point where counsel says, yes, there is probably state error in the court not allowing.
I don't think there's any question. You are bound to accept the OCCA's state law determination that the evidence was wrongly excluded. You are not bound, I'll see, to accept the constitutional error.
Part and parcel of the OCCA's harmlessness determination was they had to get there because they found it to be material and a constitutional error. So I guess you're asking us to overlook that aspect of their harmlessness determination.
I'm asking,
as though it were just separate and apart from that issue.
I don't think so. I'm going to use the materiality finding in two ways. First, to show that it's an unreasonable application of Chapman for all the reasons that I don't need to repeat. It's just unreasonable to say material evidence is harmless. Now, you're free of 2254D. You must define a constitutional error under 2254A. Mr. Coddington has to be held in custody in violation of his federal constitutional rights. But we're free of 2254D. The touchstone is Valenzuela versus Bernal, which requires a right to present a defense claim to rest on the unjustified or arbitrary exclusion of material evidence, which is to say reliable and important evidence. And I do think, while you're not bound by the OCCA's materiality judgment under your de novo review, I do believe you are bound by the subsidiary factual findings, implicit and explicit in that finding. When I think those are factual findings that are presumptively correct, because while I have surmounted 2254D's precondition on relief, I'm still able to draw on 2254E's presumption of the correctness of factual findings by the state court. Materiality, I acknowledge, is not a factual finding. It's a mixed finding, but it consists of factual findings. high on that list is that Dr. Smith's evidence was reliable and important to the defense. I think you are bound by those.
But ultimately, it's a legal finding.
Materiality.
Right.
And that ultimately, you need to make that call under de novo review. But I think that question has to be informed with some deference to the subordinate facts that inform the OCCA's materiality judgment. I wonder if I can talk briefly about the Hicks argument, because I'm not making a new claim. My claim is the right that Mr. Coddington was denied his right to present a defense. I brought forward Hicks because I don't think it's a problem, but an anomaly. What I have is a Chambers error. But one thing you'll notice in the Chambers lines of cases is that the state evidentiary rule or judicial decision was itself the constitutional problem. In other words, Chambers wasn't allowed to impeach his own witness under Mississippi law. And the Mississippi courts upheld that the exclusion participant whom he thought said had
of course we don't have it a complete we don't have that at all here. And in fact, as state's counsel points out, the Supreme Court has made those kind of distinctions, for instance in Clark, between this type of it's not factual evidence we're talking about here.
Well, let's,
and there's a difference in the weight to that.
It is
evidence.
Factual evidence. Don't be lulled into complacency.
Well, the Supreme Court has made that distinction in Clark, and they've specifically said in that case that the opinion testimony, there was no violation of a due process right
but
there.
Remember the background state law. Clark was prohibited under state law from presenting this evidence. Mr. Coddington was not. And I don't think you should be complacent about the importance of the evidence excluded here by treating it as mere opinion. For defactualizing Dr. Smith's opinion misses something important about the element, the mens rea element disputed here.
Well, the Oklahoma court has already ruled on in your favor on that point in its second opinion, correct? That it's error to exclude the opinion evidence.
Under state law. But as I acknowledge, Mr. Coddington still must convince you that exclusion violated his federal constitutional rights. And you are not bound by the OCCA's determination. You are free to reject that. I think you're subject to those subsidiary factual findings, and I think it's going to be difficult for you to come to a different conclusion when you apply Valenzuela under de novo review. But if I could go back to the opinion, the mere opinion evidence, it's misunderstanding something critically important about the elements. Mr. Coddington either did or did not have the requisite mens rea. That's a factual determination. And the jury was denied reliable and important evidence from a credentialed expert stating that he did not have that intent as a matter of fact. Now, this isn't to deny that mens rea draws on subjective moral choices, but in the first instance, under Oklahoma law, it's a factual determination. Now, I started to say the reason I introduced Hicks is to acknowledge that unlike the Chambers lines of cases, I don't have a problem with Oklahoma law. I'm embracing Oklahoma law. That's what Hicks adds to this discussion. It's not a new claim. It's just an argument, an authority, for you to grab onto as you see the way I define the error, which is, as I said at the beginning, not the exclusion qua exclusion. It's the exclusion of Dr. Smith's opinion embedded in a state law defense that he was entitled to exercise.
So, what do you mean? I had you up to the point where you said you were going to rely on Hicks, and then after that you went into all this fancy rhetoric, and I don't understand what you said. So I'm a little plain thinker, so just walk me through a little more plainly, please, instead of having me follow you like a lemming off the cliff.
I suppose I've been accused of worse things.
At appellate argument stage, we got to understand you to help you.
You do. To be clear, I am not making a new claim for relief under Hicks. I'm not changing the basis, the legal basis for my claim. I'm informing your analysis with a Supreme Court case that recognizes that a state can create rights.
When? When can it, but what makes that state created right? It's so fundamental. What makes, in this case, in light of other Supreme Court and federal law that we have, including a federal rule of evidence that excludes it, what makes it so fundamental?
It's the Chambers line of cases informs that decision. And under de novo review, what you have to decide is whether or not the state arbitrarily excluded relevant, material, important evidence critical to the defense.
Okay.
And those are the elements that on which your analysis must depend. And let's take them one at a time. There's no state interest, by definition, in excluding this evidence. It was erroneously excluded under state law. Let's take the reliability of the opinion, because I wouldn't be standing here if Dr. Smith's opinion, if I conceded that Dr. Smith's opinion was unreliable, because there's nothing wrong with excluding unreliable evidence. But the OCCA called his testimony, said it would have been helpful, called it material. Implicit in that is its reliability. And I think it was critical to Mr. Coddington's defense because it and it alone negated an element. All those elements combine, in my view, to establish a violation not of the Hicks claim, but of the right to present a defense. If there are no further questions, I rest.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Counselor excused. Thank you both for your arguments this morning.